This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Bay State Democrats pick Coakley. Senate Democrats opt out of the public option, and the president is off to Oslo. It's Wednesday and time for a prize edition of the Political Junkie.
There you go again.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Lipstick.
But I'm the decider.
Every Wednesday, NPR political editor Ken Rudin joins us to talk about politics. As usual, there's a lot to chew over. Underdog Scott Brown will carry Republican hopes for the Kennedy seat. More on that in a minute. The health bill inches ahead in the Senate. It's official. There is a new mayor in Atlanta. The architects of the Afghanistan search testify in Capitol Hill. We'll hear why progressives are skeptical a bit later. And Max Baucus joins the Questionable Sex and Ethics Caucus. But as usual, we begin with a trivia question. Ken Rudin is with us here in Studio 3A. Hey, Ken.
Hi, Neil. But before we do a little trivia, just a little thing that happened this weekend. WVTF, in the base in Roanoke, Virginia, opened up its new satellite studios in Charlottesville. And in the middle of a pretty significant snowstorm, big turnout, big fans of Talk of the Nation, big fans of Talk of public radio. And so a little tip of the hat to WVTF.
And it's funny, I was down at WJCT in Jacksonville. They said they'd never heard of you, Ken. Anyway, trivia question.
Okay, right. Well, okay. Martha Coakley has won the Democratic primary for the Senate from Massachusetts. Massachusetts has never elected, never had a female senator. Now, there is one state that has not only never had a female senator or governor, but has never had a female nominee for the Senate or a governor. What state is that?
Of a major party.
Of a major party.
All right. So if you think you know the one state without a woman so much as nominated for governor or U.S. Senate by a major party, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk at npr.org. Of course, the winner will get a fabulous no-prize T-shirt. But let's start with Massachusetts, where it will be Coakley Brown in January.
Right. Martha Coakley won the Democratic primary yesterday by a pretty significant margin, something like 47% of the vote in a four-candidate field. Second place was Michael Capuano, the congressman, who was like almost like 20 points down. So I think the Republican, who's Scott Brown, who's going to be who is the Republican nominee, his hopes for victory in the January 19th special election to actually succeed Paul Kirkus, who was holding Ted Kennedy's Senate seat, he was hoping for obviously a much closer Democratic primary, perhaps some rancor, some bitterness. And judging from what I heard last night, and WBUR streamed everything live last night, which was great, it seemed like that Coakley has the complete backing of the Democratic Party.
Well, let's turn now to WBUR, our member station in Boston. And there is Dan Payne, a Democratic media consultant. Dan, nice to have you with us today.
Hi, nice to be with you.
And this is the one time of, we can always use that word, tantamount. One of my favorite is victory in the Democratic primary tantamount to election to the United States Senate?
Well, Massachusetts is so blue, it could be called Democratistan. We have zero members of the U.S. House who are Republicans, no senators, Republicans. None of the state's constitutional officers are Republicans. Five state senators out of 40 are Republican, and 16, I think it is, of 160 state representatives are Republican. So they are an infinitesimal minority in Massachusetts.
So you would have to say it is Martha Coakley's election to lose.
Yes, which is kind of the way it was in the primary. She started ahead. Early poll showed her with a 20-point lead, and in the last poll last night, she wound up with a 20-point lead.
Dan Payne, but of course, at the same time, Massachusetts has elected three Republican governors in the past decade or so.
Yes, and the reason that happens is because this legislature is so Democratic, and they're frequently involved in scandals and mischief and whatever. And so voters in Massachusetts put a Republican in the governorship as a way of keeping an eye on the Democrats. You know, it doesn't work that way, though, in federal offices.
Yeah, you know, I'd heard of Taxachusetts, but I had never heard of Democratistan.
Well, I just made that up.
Well, all right, we're going to start something new here. So the Republican nominee, Scott Brown, he's a member of the state Senate. He's going to face a very difficult—how is he going to try to make up what is going to be a very substantial margin?
Well, independents sort of hold the balance of power in a general election. They're about 51% of the state. Democrats are 37% and Republicans are 12%. So you got to appeal to the independents. And Brown is a guy who probably wants to run for office again, even if he doesn't make it this time. So he's got to run a campaign that's responsible, that allows him to run for, say, Martha Coakley's attorney general job if he loses. Or there'll be an auditor's job open. There'll be a treasurer slot open in the state. So he's got to run a campaign that will allow him to fight another day.
And does Coakley have to guard against being too cautious?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, part of the problem for Brown, and I'm sure Coakley will take advantage of this, is that, you know, we're going to have two holidays falling between now and the general election, which is January 19th. So there'll probably be a little more campaigning this week and a little bit next week. And then the campaign will shut down for a couple of weeks as the holidays come. And it's going to be really hard for Brown to break through two of the 6 weeks in the general election.
One of Coakley's advantages in the primary was name recognition. She was the only candidate who had run statewide before. She'll have that same advantage in the general.
Absolutely. People know her. They're comfortable with her. I saw polls toward the end of this campaign that had her cruising at 70-plus percent favorability and a very low negative, maybe in the teens. If anything, that probably grew more last night. So Scott Brown's got a lot of ground to make up, and he didn't, you know, he had a primary, but he was running against a nut. And so winning big, as he did with 80-some percent of the vote, was relatively meaningless. And there weren't debates. There was one kind of small confrontation toward the end of the campaign, but Brown never got a chance to explain who he is in debates.
And is he going to have any money?
That sort of depends on whether the National Republicans want him to run a well-funded race. You know, I say if he doesn't get national money, he's going to find getting money in Massachusetts extremely difficult because Coakley is well-regarded in the legal community. They give big bucks. She regulates nonprofits as the attorney general, so nonprofits will be actively involved in her campaign financially. I think she'll be able to raise money very easily, and Brown will have a very hard time. But Brown's got to worry about one thing, which is he can't come across as a national Republican. The way Massachusetts Republicans who succeed run is by being fiscal conservatives and social moderates. And Brown already is not a social moderate. He's opposed to gay marriage. He's for the death penalty. He has a number of positions on abortion. No one knows quite what his position on abortion is. He's a pretty hard right Republican in a state that is very blue.
All right. Dan Payne, thanks very much. I'm sure we'll be checking with you as the election approaches in January.
My pleasure.
Democratic media consultant Dan Payne joined us from the studios of our member station in Boston, WBUR. We have some people on the line who think they know the answer to this week's trivia question, which again is there is one state in the union which has in which a major party has never nominated a female to run for United States Senate or for governor, much less elected one. If you think you know the answer, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. We'll start with Jennifer. Jennifer with us from Tallahassee.
Is it Florida?
Well, Florida, no, because Paula Hawkins was a senator in the 1980s. Matter of fact, Paula Hawkins died this week, Florida's first female senator, but she was elected in 1980 in the Reagan landslide, so it's not Florida.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for the call, Jennifer. Let's see if we go next to Shelley. Shelley with us from Athens. Is this Athens, Ohio or Georgia?
Athens, Ohio.
Go ahead, please.
I only heard the governor part, but I was going to say Ohio.
Well, no, because also, if you remember, Mary Boyle was the Democratic nominee against Senator Voinovich a couple of years back. I think it was 1998, so
right.
We did have a female nominee for the Senate.
Yep, I missed that part of the question. Thanks.
Okay, Shelley, thanks very much. Let's go next to Scott. Scott with us from Oklahoma City.
Hi, yeah, is it Oklahoma?
Oklahoma.
Well, no, because there was a woman named Laura Boyd who ran for governor against Frank Keating in 1998.
Oh, okay, you're right. Yeah, I forgot all about that.
I would say, don't you hate it when Ken is right?
I do.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Scott. And we'll go next to Mark. And Mark's with us calling from the Badlands of South Dakota.
Hey, guys, Ken's almost always right, you know.
I know. Almost, wow.
Everybody's sticking with their home states here, and I got to go with South Dakota.
Does that mean you're ignoring Senator Gladys Pyle of the 1930s?
Okay, that was a little before me.
Well, it's 2 weeks before me, but...
Thanks very much for the call, Mark. Drive carefully.
Thank you.
Actually, the reason nobody knows Gladys Pyle is because she was always among her peers.
Yes. Let's go to William. William with us from Sturgeon Bay in Wisconsin.
Hi. Is it Wisconsin?
I assume it's Sturgeon Bay.
Pardon me?
Go ahead. Anyway, well, yes, you're on the air. Go ahead.
It's not Wisconsin.
Oh, it's not Wisconsin.
Because Susan Engelider ran against Herb Kohl for the Senate in 1988.
Ah, okay.
Okay,
No incumbent, no senator, no governor, but also no nominee for the Senate or governor.
Mary's on the line from Aiken, South Carolina.
Is it South Carolina?
Well, just a few years ago, Inez Tenenbaum, you remember that name, ran against Jim DeMint for the Senate. So it's not South Carolina.
All right, nice try, Mary. Let's see if we can go to Sharon, and Sharon's with us from Salt Lake City.
Iowa?
No, not Iowa, because there was, there was Roxanne Conlon, who, as you well remember, ran for governor against Terry Branstad in the 1980s, I believe.
Well, at least she picked her, not her home state, anyway.
Right.
Thanks for the call, Sharon. And let's see if we squeeze in one more before we have to go to the break. And this is Mike, and Mike's with us also from Aiken, South Carolina.
And I think my guess was South Carolina, and that's what the person ahead of me said.
And it's still wrong.
Oh, well, backward and everything else. I just figured it had to be South Carolina.
Well, Ken, we just have a few seconds left. I think, wait a minute, we got one more caller in. Let's go to Mike. Mike with us from Marcy in New York.
Yeah, how's it going?
Good. What's your guess?
My guess is Hawaii.
Hawaii.
Oh, no, the governor right now is Linda Lingle. Who is a female.
I was trying to pick an obscure state, but...
Never mind. I'm afraid we're out of time.
I get the T-shirt.
Wait a minute. There's an answer coming in by email. We're giving you the winner. We've got a winning answer coming in by email. We're going to give it to you after the break. Wait a minute. Here it is. It is Jesse in Charlotte, North Carolina says Mississippi.
Correct answer.
You know you're going to get a T-shirt. All right, Jerry, we're going to email you back, and we'll give you the... Hey, stay with us. It's Talk of the Nation for Interview News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Later in the program, politics in Afghanistan and an argument that at least parts of the Taliban have to share power there. But first, political junkie Ken Rudin is with us, as he is every Wednesday. You can read his blog and listen to his podcast if you go to npr.org. And we now focus on the politics of Afghanistan. President Obama knew that the surge would be unpopular with the left of the Democratic Party that forms an important part of his political base. But he made sure to specify an exit strategy in his speech at West Point.
I have determined that it is in our vital national interest to send an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan. After 18 months, our troops will begin to come home.
But that timetable seemed to slip by the time administration officials appeared on the Sunday talk shows. This is Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on NBC's Meet the Press.
We're not talking about an exit strategy or a drop-dead deadline. What we're talking about is an assessment that in January 2011, we can begin a transition to hand off responsibility to the Afghan forces.
And this week, the military commander in Afghanistan also stressed the importance of waiting until a year from January before evaluating the surge. We want to hear from progressives in the audience today. What message does this send to the anti-war activists who helped candidate Obama in the Democratic primaries? Are you willing to give the president the benefit of the doubt now? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk at npr.org. You can also join our conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And joining us here in Studio 3A is Faz Shakir, a research director for the Center for American Progress and editor-in-chief of thinkprogress.org. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
And what do you take from the president's speech and then the apparent switch by Sunday?
Well, it's clear that he was trying to talk to two different audiences in the speech. So on the one sentence, he said that we're not going to withdraw. We're going to stay there. We got to commit 30,000 extra troops to try to win this effort. And that's clearly an effort to win over the people who are proponents of staying in Afghanistan. But then in the very next sentence, it's telling that he says we're going to leave in 18 months. So I think he's trying to draw in his progressive base that's very concerned that there isn't a recipe for success, particularly through the addition of more troops. And I think that over the course of the weekend, you see some of his more hawkish military advisors, and you also played some clips from Secretary Clinton, who are, I think, trying to shape the rhetorical terrain so that it will create the breathing space, if you will, for them to politically stay longer if necessary.
What, do you think they were going beyond what the president wanted them to say?
I think that they are instituting some of their own desires to keep as much flexibility in the war plan as much as possible. The president, of course, has his own political considerations. I don't mean to suggest that they were the reason he instituted his plan, but I think the rhetoric was shaped in such a way to make sure that he could mollify the various audiences that he was speaking to. But they have a very different constituency. So you see the military saying, well, if we need to stay past 20 months, then we got to start using rhetoric right now that's going to allow us to stay.
So the Secretary of State, appointed by the President of the United States, the head of the National Security Council, who serves at the President's pleasure and is not to have to be confirmed by the Senate or anybody else, those two people who appeared on the Sunday talk shows, much less General McChrystal, Admiral Mullen, and the ambassador to Kabul, all of whom serve at the pleasure of the President, are going beyond what the White House told them to say?
I think that they're trying to ensure that they have the rhetorical space to continue with the war plan beyond 18 months. And I think it's a shame that they feel like there's still an internal struggle that's playing out in public. I think that they had debated this for months, I think at least 3 months, hopefully had come to terms with the fact that they were going to begin a withdrawal at 18 months. But I think that there are still some elements of the administration, particularly in the military. I think General Petraeus and General Jim Jones, who's a national security advisor, amongst others, who are saying that this may begin, but we're going to keep 100,000 troops there even beyond 18 months, so be prepared. And I think that that's sending the wrong message, undercutting what President Obama had to say to West Point cadets.
When all he would have to do is tell his press secretary, Robert Gibbs, to say, wait a minute, that's not quite right. We're going to start pulling out in 18 months.
And at some point it may come to that, but right now I think that they're still trying to gauge the political fallout from all this. I think they're, on the one hand, the policy is set in stone. They feel like in 18 months they're going to start to begin a withdrawal. But that policy is being shaped rhetorically in so many different ways, and I think that that's what they need to start getting under control. And I'm concerned that the rhetoric of those who have intentions of staying longer may outweigh and voice over those who would like to see that withdrawal begin in 18 months.
Including their boss, the president. Ken?
When the president said at West Point that he was talking about a timetable for begin withdrawing troops in July 2011, immediately people like John McCain said, this is giving a signal to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban that you don't want to do that. You don't want to do a timetable to the enemy. And then as we heard the administration figures speaking over the weekend that perhaps gave some ease to the McCains. What ease has the left, the progressives, heard from the White House since the West Point speech?
You know, I think coming out of the West Point speech, there were progressives who were heartened to see what they thought was an exit strategy articulated by the president. They didn't want to call it that, but it seemed clear that 18 months was going to begin the end of our presence in Afghanistan. It was clear that the president said we're not going to stay forever.
No blank check.
And we're going to tell the Afghanistan people we're not occupiers. We're ready to leave. Then, I think that president even boxed himself in that speech, because if you look at the 18 months timetable, he's boxing himself politically, because he will be up for re-election at a time when he will actually have to decide whether he's going to hold to that 18 months or not. And if he does not, he risks, of course, fracturing and alienating the very progressive base that helped put him in power.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Andre is with us from Oakland.
Yes, I think that we don't need to give the president the benefit of that. We need to give him a piece of our mind. Just because he said it, it sounds like it's a turd that's dipped in some honey, and he's very good at framing it. But he needs to know this progressive base is upset, and you need to end the war. How long are we going to be there? And if it's not going to end, just tell the people, we're going to be here forever. Let's start building military bases and just say that. Rather than all this, the nuance, and talking about, there's no timetable. We need to evaluate. Well, we've been evaluating this war since, 2003? How long does it take to evaluate it?
at least since 2001 anyway, when it started.
Afghan started in 2001 probably,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
when did
indeed.
We start with them?
Yeah, no, this is, we're talking about Afghanistan here.
When did we start with them?
In 2001, yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah, that's been
it's
a long time, 8 years.
War.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call, Andre. And he represents the view of people like Congressman McGovern of Massachusetts, who says, wait a minute, we're going to have a vote. We should stop funding this. We should tell the president, no, we need to start pulling these troops out now.
Right, and there's a cost-benefits issue here, particularly as we're debating health care, that you have $100 billion that either goes to Afghanistan or either goes to health care for all Americans. And I think that for many progressive activists, they see that as an easy cost-benefit. Let's invest here at home. The other thing I'd say is to defend Obama just very quickly. I think he saw the past 8 years in Afghanistan as a lack of investment and a lack of a strategy for success. And I think he's saying to himself and to his advisors, let's give this one shot. We've got 18 months. Let's give it one shot and then see if what happens from that.
Let's go next to Nate. Nate Withers from Avon in Colorado.
Hey there. I feel like my progressive base is being somewhat dishonest in a way. I mean, Obama, throughout the campaign and even into his presidency, always said he was going to adjust his focus on Afghanistan. It was always one of the things he would talk about. And I don't know why my base is just freaking out. I mean, as though are they pretending he did not say these things and wishing that he didn't say these things?
Nate is absolutely.
I don't feel bad at all. I think he's doing exactly what he said, and I'm glad he's focusing more on Afghanistan now.
And Nate is correct. That is what the president campaigned on.
The president certainly campaigned on that. He also campaigned on withdrawing from Iraq. We see that the rhetoric and the policy changes over time due to realities on the ground. And I think many progressives said that the reality in Afghanistan is changing and that the president's view of the policy and the cost that policy would inflict on his administration needed to change as well. And I think the president went through a three-month process where I think he said he listened to all points of view. I think one thing that the progressives were upset about that during that process of review, the option of withdrawing immediately or at least putting that on the table was rejected out of hand. It was never actually considered, according to the president and his advisors. They never put that on the table. I think that there was a concern that the views of people who would like to see a withdrawal were never accurately reflected or given the attention they deserved.
All right, Nate, thanks very much for the call. Let's see if we go next to this is Daniel. Daniel Withers from Santa Rosa, California.
Hi, I am a progressive, and I would like to say I disagree with what your people just said a minute ago. I feel that I was lied to over this whole withdrawal. Obama put himself right next to John Kerry and saying he was going to take on the whole Afghan problem as a police action. We look at that as a complete drawdown in the war. Now, the people in the Edwards camp and everybody told us all along that Hillary Clinton and Obama were being, how about this, disingenuous to us.
Well, that was about the war in Iraq. There was not talking about Afghanistan.
No. That was also about Afghanistan. And I can look right now and see New York Times articles where Obama came out and said he supported John Kerry's idea of treating even Afghanistan and going after Osama bin Laden as a police action.
I think that was in terms of prosecution rather than prosecution
of
the war.
Yes, yes, and that is where we're angry. So to come back out with this, I don't know the words to use, but to come out with this disingenuous argument that Obama never said this. Well, how about this? I was solicited number of times because I give to the Democratic Party and I'm a volunteer for the Democratic Party, and I've worked on campaigns for the Democratic Party, but I was solicited time and time again and told by Obama people that he was going to stop the wars, period.
All right. Daniel, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. Let's go next to, this is Melba. Melba in Charlotte.
Hi. I couldn't disagree with Daniel more. Obama always said he was going to escalate in Afghanistan, and I don't understand where these people are coming away with this from. I mean, they voted for him, and I volunteered for Obama, and I worked for Obama, and he always talked about getting out of Iraq and going, you know, more into Afghanistan.
That's more my memory of it as well.
Okay, that's it. I support the president and what he's doing because he campaigned on it.
All right, Melba, thanks very much for the call. Emails from Mary in Iowa City. Many of the peace advocates in Iowa City did not support Obama. I am an anti-war supporter who did. Unfortunately, Obama did not speak to those people who are anti-war and did not vote for him, so he would never be able to convince these hard left progressives. And this from Donna in Medford, Washington. I was against the war from the start. I am part of the progressive base, but I voted for President Obama because I trust his judgment more than anything. I think we need someone with good judgment who knows all the facts, deciding what we should be doing. I wish Congress would get behind the president. And Ken, this is not an issue that's going to go away.
No, not at all. And of course, it's the Republicans who are probably enjoying this the most because they know that for the Obama policy on Afghanistan to succeed, it's going to have to be the Republican support because we're seeing more and more Democrats who feel that they were betrayed, even though, as we've correctly said, Obama has campaigned on the fact that Afghanistan is the good war. But more and more Democrats in the House and Senate are very nervous about the escalation.
And Faz Shakir, do you think those Democrats in the House and Senate are going to be pressing for an early vote up or down on Afghanistan?
Well, I think the majority of Democrats, both in the House and the Senate, are going to end up supporting the president's policy, but it's going to come at a cost. I think that the Congressman Obie's proposal to institute a war tax might actually end up gaining some favor. I think people are going to want to see that there's some cost inflicted, that the American people understand the cost that are inflicted with this war, and that that cost is shared politically as well across the board.
Although Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker, dismissed that out of hand.
Right, yeah. She did, but I think there'll be more support from it in different places.
Now, Faz Shakir, thank you very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Faz Shakir, Research Director at the Center for American Progress and Editor-in-Chief of thinkprogress.org and The Progress Report, who was kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to Talk of the Nation and The Political Junkie from NPR News. And Ken, getting back to some of that political news, we lost amid all the excitement over the trivia question this week. There is a finality now. A recount demanded yesterday in Atlanta in the mayoral race. It's over today.
It's over. Kasim Reed, who led by about 700 votes, wins by 714 votes. He is African-American, and the only reason I point that out is that Mary Norwood, who is a white challenger, was hoping to be the first white elected in Atlanta since 1969. It's not happening. She asked for a recount. She did not get it. Kasim Reed will be the next mayor of Atlanta.
And there is another senator who is in some political hot water after he submitted his girlfriend's name for a nomination as United States Attorney.
Well, Max Baucus of Montana, who's the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, shortly after President Obama was elected, he submitted three names to be possible U.S. attorneys of Montana. That's a beaut. And, one of them happened to be a woman by the name of Melody Haynes, who was his girlfriend. Of course, she withdrew her name from consideration. And some people are saying, well, maybe this is more sexism because, after all, Tim Johnson, the senator from South Dakota, his son was nominated as a U.S. attorney, and nobody's making a big deal of that.
And Senator Baucus was separated from his wife at the time.
That's
right. She was single, too, so this is not involved in any allegations of...
And no personal gain on Baucus's behalf, right?
And her name wasn't Helena. So anyway, moving right along, news in the governor's race in the state of Texas, where Kay Bailey Hutchison, the Republican U.S. Senator, is now entered to run against Rick Perry.
Right. She hinted about it 4 years ago, but ultimately decided not to run. Now she has filed for the March 2nd primary. Rick Perry, Kay Bailey Hutchison, and also a woman who's close to the Tea Party, Deborah Medina, will be the three Republicans. Also, Houston Mayor Bill White has decided to leave the Senate race, run for governor, and it looks like he will be the Democratic nominee against a fractured Republican party.
And it looks like the new polls in Nevada show the political opinions of the current sitting Republican governor, well, just soaring.
Good news. Excellent news for Jim Gibbons. The latest poll, he's obviously a very embattled governor going through a very ugly and publicized divorce. His approval ratings is now up to 19%, up from 14% in October, 7% in June, slightly above the political junkie.
And it could be another Mayor Landrieu in New Orleans.
Right. Lieutenant Governor Mitch Landrieu, who's the brother of Senator Mary Landrieu. He's run twice for mayor of New Orleans and lost both times. Ray Nagin Hagan is term limited in New Orleans, and Michel Andrew announced yesterday he's going to run for mayor.
And it could not be, may not be a cakewalk for the governor of Illinois in his Democratic Party primary.
No, Pat Quinn, who became governor when the Honorable Rod Blagojevich was impeached and then removed from office. Pat Quinn is an opponent, the three-term state controller Dan Hines. This week, the Illinois Federation of Teachers, which is a very potent, powerful political organization in Illinois, endorsed Hines over Quinn.
So that you have to see how that shakes out of the bottle then.
Yes. Okay. 57 varieties on that one. Right?
Okay. Ken Rudin, thanks very much. Ken Rudin, our political junkie and NPR's political editor, joins us here on the Political Junkie segment every Wednesday on Talk of the Nation. Again, you can read his blog and listen to his podcast, as if you haven't had enough already, at npr.org. Coming up, wartime politics inside Afghanistan. Azeem Ibrahim argues that the only way to succeed there is to swallow hard and give the Taliban a seat at the table. He joins us next. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.